Well, we're coming to the end of the first chapter of Daniel, and the focus in this paragraph that we're looking at this evening is on the outcome of Daniel's and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's commitment. And we talked last time, most of y'all weren't here, so I'm repeating myself. We pointed out last time in our study that Daniel's decision, as it's recorded in verse 8 particularly, and then in the way that he worked the situation out to where he could eat a vegetarian diet rather than having the king's meat and wine. From a New Testament perspective and from a more fundamental perspective, this decision not to eat the food that the king was serving and drinking his wine was really a pretty minor issue. Jesus said in the New Testament, that's not what goes in your mouth that defiles you, but what comes out. And Mark says that he said that, thus making all meats clean. And then Paul said to the Corinthians, and he had two different takes on it. One of them was, there's no such thing as another God, so eating meat sacrificed to an idol was meat sacrificed to a nothing, so it was okay to eat it, as long as you could live with your conscience. And that's an issue particularly for the Jews, because some of them, it was so ingrained in them that they couldn't, I mean, straightforward reason didn't overrule the depth of the conviction, so they couldn't do it without violating their conscience. So they just wouldn't. And, of course, you're not any better off if you eat or if you don't eat, as far as God's concerned. So, but my point last time was that this whole record is Daniel is actually putting his life on the line for a very insignificant issue, except that his God had told him not to eat certain kind of food and stuff, so he wasn't going to do it. And we just made the point that this chapter is focusing on what Jesus taught when he said that we need to pay attention to the small things, because the person who's faithful with the small thing is the one that will be rewarded with more responsibility. And I said last time that a lot of times we tend to think that we can just ignore the small things and just make sure that we're not doing anything that's too big. But that's completely contrary to the issue here. And as we said in our early studies in chapter 1, the issue of the book of Daniel is worshiping the true God. That's the issue. And that's the message that's going to go to the Gentiles in the face of their polytheism, and it's the issue that the Jews had ignored, so that they had ignored enough Sabbath year accumulation to end up owing the land 70 years of rest, and that's why God, that's what 2 Corinthians says is the reason God sent them off to Babylon, so that the land could get its rest. Now, the issue is bigger than that, because even the observance of the Sabbath, that's not a repeated issue in the New Testament. You don't have to observe the Sabbath in the New Testament. And the reason is because in the Old Testament, observing the Sabbath wouldn't have been a big deal either, except that God made the observance of the Sabbath the mark of the covenant. It's kind of like taking the Lord's table, because Jesus said, this is my blood in the new covenant, and as often as you do this, do it in remembrance of me. And Paul said, you can get in big trouble if you don't treat the body and blood of the Lord properly in your observance of that. So they're taking some amoral issues and making them moral issues by God putting that requirement on them for a particular reason. And to ignore the Sabbath was basically just a statement, I don't care about being in covenant relationship with God. So that's really what's going on here. And so this evening what we're going to do is look at verses 17 and following, because the outcome of it was, and we all know the story, God, it says in verse 17 that as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams, and at the end of the days when the king had specified for presenting them, the prince of the eunuchs, or New American Standard says, I think erroneously, the commander of the officials, but nonetheless, he presented them before Nebuchadnezzar, and then Nebuchadnezzar went one-on-one with each of these Jewish young men that they had school for 3 years, and not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, so they were incorporated in the king's service. And it says in verse 20 that as for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. And then it says Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. So that's what we're going to be looking at this evening. But the issue is that their determination to be loyal to God, God turned around and did more than he had promised. Because in Habakkuk 2:4, he had promised that they wouldn't be killed during the Babylonian captivity thing by the Babylonians in their warfare and all that. The just by faith shall live. But he didn't say what quality of life or any of that kind of stuff. And we talked already about some of the things that they had to suffer just because of the brutality of the Babylonians. So this whole thing of, actually it's a record of God's reaction to their loyalty, because it says God gave them this stuff. So that's what we were going to look at this evening. I'd like to start out with a statement in verse 17, as for these 4 youths. Because it's clear, I mean, he talking about 4 young men that were from the high houses of Judah, verse 6, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and they had their names changed, but Daniel didn't go with the changed names. In verse 19, where the king talked to each one of them, he continues with their Hebrew name. But it's interesting that he says, as for these 4 youths. If you look that word up in the way it's used in the Old Testament, it's not used very often, but it's interesting where it is used, because the word translated youth is used in Genesis 21:8 to refer to Isaac before he's weaned. And of course, you can't bring 21st century American weaning issues into that mix there. So I just went online and looked at what the commentator said about when did they wean these kids. And it's really strange. The typical weaning period was 2 years. They'd breastfeed their babies for 2 years. But sometimes they would breastfeed up to 7 years. But I just wondered why he used the word youth in relation to these 4 with a term that's not used very often in the text. And so I thought when I read 21:8 that maybe it meant, you know, a small child. But then in chapter 21, verses 14 to 16, it refers to Ishmael at the time when he and Hagar are banished from Abraham's household. Well, if you remember that story, Ishmael was born when Abraham was 86. And then Isaac came along when he was 100. So Ishmael was 14 years old when Isaac was born. And if you add a couple of years to Isaac's when he's weaned, then you have Ishmael being 16 years old. And if you add 7 years, well, he's 21. And he's still called a youth. And so you got this word that's used of a 2-year-old, and the same word is used of someone that might be as old as 21. And so obviously it's not the age of the child that determines the use of this term. So I got curious as to why he would use this particular term for these 4 young men, because we still don't know how old they were. I mean, we're guessing when we say they were probably in their mid-teens, but that guess is based on partly on the end of the paragraph where Daniel continues until the first year of Cyrus, but he actually continued longer than that because he was actually a part of Cyrus's ruling men for 2 or 3 years. But the first year of Cyrus was somewhere around 537. Maybe earlier than that, for 538, 539, somewhere along in there. I checked the number by the side of my brain. But my point is, that would have made Daniel, from the time he was carried off into Babylon at 606 down to 536, that would have been at least 70 years. And then he's a youth before he was hauled off. So, you know, he's 85 or maybe even close to 90 years old. So we're guessing when we say they were in their mid-teens. But this term doesn't have that connotation. So I got to looking. And it's interesting that this same word is used by Ashpenaz in verse 10. And it said, the commander of the officials or the prince of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Now that's the New American Standard Translation. 1769, King James says, of your sort. Yeah. The issue though is that the New American Standard Translators assume it's an age thing. It's not. We already showed that. 2 to 21. It's not an age thing. And then, of your sort is the way the translators, at least in one translation of King James, tried to give the impression that is something about those youth. And I was still curious, what sort are they? What's the issue here? And so I got to looking at it, and this is the only time in the Old Testament that this particular word is translated youth or child or sort. Every other time, it's about rejoicing. And you say, what in the world? Well, then it began to dawn on me that the implication that Ashpenaz mentions of the youths that were the cause of great rejoicing was back when they were identified as to who they were in the first part of the chapter, because the king ordered Ashpenaz to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including the royal family and the nobles, youths who are no defect, good-looking, showing intelligence and all that kind of stuff. But I got to thinking about that. I think that the connection between the youth and the rejoicing thing perhaps is, and maybe even more than perhaps, it's probable that these are firstborns, that these young men are the firstborns of their families. They're the cause of great rejoicing for their, particularly their dad, but also for the mom. Because that's the way it was in the Old Testament. The firstborn was always greeted with great rejoicing, enthusiasm. And of course, that's particularly true with Isaac, because Sarah named him Laughter because she was going to have laughter in her old age, having this baby. It's going to be a fantastic experience of rejoicing. And so I got to looking at or thinking about that, and I thought, if I were the king and I wanted these people that I'd conquered to behave themselves, and I was going to take some hostages of their children to make sure they behave themselves, which ones would I take? I'd take the ones that were most important to the parents. So, I just decided that the real issue of the word is not the age of the person, but the attitude the parents have toward the person. These are youths in the eyes of their parents who are extremely important to them. They were a cause of great rejoicing when they were born. And then I saw a text over there in Genesis 4:23 where it's given the genealogy of Cain. I don't know if you've ever paid any attention or not, but there are two genealogies that are given in Genesis before the flood. One of them is the line of Cain, and the other is the line of Seth. Both of those genealogies go down through, and they end up, the last person in the genealogy before the flood, on both those lines, the person's named Lamech. Lamech was the son of Cain before that was before the flood. And Seth's genealogy comes down, and his final son before the flood was also named Lamech, which might be a little hint as to why the flood came. Because Cain set the pattern, murdering his brother, and then his genealogy is a record of some pretty bad people, and Lamech is the worst of the bunch. Because when you read about the Lamech that came through Cain, he's the first polygamist. And he's bragging in Genesis 4:23 because he killed a youth for wounding him. He's boasting that he killed somebody's firstborn because that kid did something to him. He calls it wounding, but it probably
made him feel bad.
He might have goaded him into some kind of a altercation. The kid might have socked him, you know, but he killed him. And that just makes Lamech stand out as a horrible kind of person because he's bragging about killing somebody's firstborn, if my understanding of this word's right. And on the Seth side, which is the godly man, but his offspring are degenerating too, because by the time of the flood, there's only one guy in his family on the planet that God's going to spare. And that guy's name is Lamech. So they both come together as pretty rotten. And that's the condition of the human race before God wipes it out, except for Noah and his sons and their wives and his wife. So, I really think...
Noah's father or grandfather?
Yeah, I think he was the father of Noah.
Was it Seth one or the other one?
Seth one.
Okay. I just don't remember the genealogy there.
No, and in fact, Methuselah is on the Seth side too. And the name Methuselah means, at least it's been interpreted to mean, when he dies it shall come. And he actually died the year of the flood. Now whether he died in the flood or he died just before the flood, we don't know. But his age and the timing, the coming of the flood came together. In Methuselah's 969th year, the flood came upon the earth. But the whole human race on both sides of the coin, Cain and Seth, had degenerated to the point where God said, they're only evil continually. I'm sorry I made them, and I'm going to kill them all. Except Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. However, this Genesis 4 thing also indicates why Abraham, or it deepens our appreciation of Abraham's affection for Isaac, because he's a youth. He's one of these that's specially favored by the parent. This causes great rejoicing. And Ishmael is called a youth in the story where he's booted out of the house with his mom. And his mom, it says she carried him. Here he is between 16 and 20 years old. But she puts him down in a brush pile and walks away because she didn't want to watch him die. And it says that Abraham was sorry he had to boot them out because he really loved Ishmael. And Ishmael was his firstborn, technically. So it strengthens our understanding of this whole issue of the emotional involvement of the parents. And it's the reason in this chapter that the king has them as hostages. He wants to make sure that the Jews in Judea behave themselves. It doesn't work. I mean, it works for a few years. But I think then that on the top of the second page, we could translate the word with the phrase, the favorite sons. So as for these four favorite sons, God gave them. And I really think that it underscores the losses that Judah suffered because of what I just call the careless evil of the people and ignoring the Sabbath. I don't think that the Jews, when they were ignoring those sabbatical requirements, I don't think they were looking down the road as to what it's going to cost them. Nobody, almost nobody ever does. What's this going to cost me? But Daniel went into this first chapter setting with the determination that he was not going to defile himself. He was going to be faithful to God. God had given him a promise that those that were just by faith would live. He was justified by faith. He had a relationship of that kind with God, and he simply was going to be faithful in the little things as well as the big things, and God then responded. So I think that the use of the term underscores God's own particular exceptional rejoicing over these four because they had set their hearts to observe his dietary instructions, and we've already said that's a relatively minor set of laws compared to, for example, the Ten Commandments. I mean, thou shalt not commit murder is a serious thing. We would say that's a biggie. And eating the meat that the king provided, we would consider that. But not Daniel. He understood the principle that Jesus emphasized, that if you're faithful in a little thing, then you can be trusted with more. If you're not faithful in a little thing, then there's a real good possibility you can't be trusted with greater stuff. So, they put their lives on the line in order to serve Yahweh, the God of Judea, or the Jews, in spite, and I think this is important, in spite of the treatment that Nebuchadnezzar had subjected them to. So, the other observation I made about these four in this paragraph is that they were included primarily because the information is going to be dealt with in chapters 3 and 6. You remember in the chiastic structure of the Babylonian side or the Chaldean language issues of that of these chapters, you had 2 and 7, which were visions, and then you had 3 and 6, and then you had 4 and 5. Well, that 3 and 6 are, 3 is the fiery furnace and 6 is the lion's den. So there are parallel themes of God delivering those who believe him. Trust him, because that's what he promised through Habakkuk. The just by faith shall live. So, it says here in verse 17 that Elohim gave them, he gave them all the stuff that they needed. He gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. And Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Now, the term that's translated there, God, is the word Elohim. It's the typical term for the idea of God. The nations use the term referring to their gods. Elohim is actually what they call a dual in Hebrew. It's not a single individual, but it's not a big plurality either. It's a dual. There's at least two. And this is just a hint. In Genesis, the statement was, let us make man after our image. So there's a plural issues there. And of course, our New Testament triunity has three in the Godhead. So Elohim refers to that, but the fundamental focus of Elohim is the exercise of power. And you got to remember that in light of chapter 1, because it was, according to the declaration, it wasn't Elohim that gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. It was the Lord, the master, Adonai. But he gave some of the vessels of the house of Elohim into his hand, too. And you remember that study where we talked about how they misunderstood the theology of rooting your concept of who the God is on the basis of the power, especially in military conquest. That's a big mistake. But Elohim gave them, and I really believe that the whole idea there is when you find God being identified as Elohim, you're talking about his use of power in some way. So here we have a declaration that God empowered their abilities. The boys were naturally intelligent, according to the instructions to Aspenaz. He was supposed to take these kids that were no defect, good-looking, and showing intelligence. So they had some natural IQ issues, but I don't believe that there's anything natural about, for example, Daniel being able to understand visions and dreams. This is a special empowerment. And it goes along with our New Testament understanding of how God has placed his spirit within us, and with the spirit came certain abilities that we didn't have before. And they're empowered abilities given by the Spirit of God. So here, there are these areas. There was one that was the issue of knowledge, and that word's only used 6 times in the whole Old Testament. And it was especially a favorite of Solomon in his prayer. Because 3 of the 6 times that it's used are found in 2 Chronicles verses 10, 11, and 12, where Solomon asks God for the knowledge to be able to be a good king. And God says, well, since you asked for that, I'll give you that, and then I'll give you all this wealth too. Because you didn't ask for wealth, you asked for knowledge. But I'll just give you the other stuff because you didn't ask for it. So the whole point here is, the issue of knowledge was a skill that was given by God so that Solomon could rule in Israel, and God knew that Nebuchadnezzar wanted these youths to be trained for service as rulers in his kingdom. So he gave them knowledge. And then he gave them what's called intelligence in every branch of literature. That's the New American Standard translation. But skill in all learning, and the word learning is a word that refers to information stored up in writings, like in scrolls, or we would say in books. But apparently, there was a fairly significant amount of Babylonian literature that was a part of their education for the 3 years. And these guys glommed onto it like they understood it real well. And it's because God gave them the ability to do that. It was a skill in understanding the writings of these Babylonians in all of their literature. And then the issue of wisdom that is raised. Wisdom in the Old Testament is fundamentally the ability to use knowledge so that the way you do something produces a good result. I mean, we talk about a person being a fool if he does something that we consider really stupid because of the way it works out. I mean, we don't consider somebody being foolish or stupid if they do something and the result's good. It's when they do something that's self-defeating and it blows up in their face. We say, well, that was a stupid thing to do. And we even tell ourselves that when we... Yeah, you pick up a 16-ounce hammer and hit your thumb with it while you're driving it. You say, that was a stupid thing to do. Well, but my point is that wisdom is considered superior to knowledge because you can have knowledge, but if you don't know how to use it, you're not wise. But you are wise if the knowledge that you have, you're able to discern that. Okay, how do I apply this in this situation? And you decide, well, I'm going to apply it this way, and then it works out well. You say, well, he's a wise man. And God gave them wisdom. Well, wisdom as a word just means the ability to use knowledge effectively to produce a good result.
It's also the spirit of wisdom.
Yes.
It's part of the sevenfold spirit.
But I think that in this case, Daniel's wisdom, well, these four youths' wisdom is from the Spirit. Because it says in chapter 2 that Daniel is identified by the king as a man in whom the Spirit of God is.
Okay.
And it says in this verse 17 that God empowered their wisdom, which implies that there's some activity of the Spirit of God in that regard.
And of course, the Proverbs says that wisdom is... Again, wisdom is the fear of the Lord, understanding God, and that is the beginning of wisdom.
Yes, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but it says wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom, but with all you're getting, get understanding, which is the ability to use.
Yeah, that's right.
And then it says that Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. And one of the things I want to make you guys aware of as we're going into the rest of the book of Daniel is that this chapter 1 is stage setting. He's telling us things that we're going to need to know so that later on when the things are described, we say, oh yeah, that was started back there in chapter 1. Just like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. We're not told that they're the only four that were faithful, but we are told that those four were, and then in chapters 3 and 6, the reason is given. The same thing here about Daniel understanding visions and dreams. Well, what's the first rattle out of the box in chapter 2? The king has a dream. His astrologers and magicians can't figure out what it means. And so Daniel gives him the meaning. And then all of a sudden we're rolling in the record of the prophecies. So, that's what's going on in verse 17, is God is responding to this decision to be faithful in the little things, and Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are being given by God a set of abilities that the king can recognize. So, in verse 18, at the end of the days, when the king had specified presenting them, the prince of the eunuchs presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. And that's kind of interesting because in verse 18, the first part, it's the king, and at the end of it, it's Nebuchadnezzar. So he's deliberately focusing on the king who was Nebuchadnezzar. And, of course, that's going to be a big, big deal in chapters 2, 3, and 4. Because chapters 2, 3, and 4 are God's dealings with Nebuchadnezzar. And at the end of chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar is acknowledging the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as the true God. Comes to his own conversion experience, if you want to call it that. And then it says in verse 19 that the king talked with them. And so the prince of the eunuchs produced the favorite sons of Judah for the king's evaluation after the time allotted. And then Nebuchadnezzar apparently sat down with each one of them and talked to them about the things that he wanted to see if they understood. And keep in mind that he's trying to Babylonize them. I told you, you'll never find that word in the dictionary. But he's trying to erase their Judean theology and practice and superimpose on it Babylon's theology and practices. That's the whole point. He changed their names to turn them into to Babylonians, and he educated them on all of the understanding of Babylon and Babylonian things and all their literature and all that, because he wanted them to think like Babylonians. He wanted to put them in his service and have a kingdom that was pushing the agenda of Babylon, which was Nebuchadnezzar's agenda. But he wanted it to be done by these favorite sons of Judah, so that the Jews back there in Judea would behave, not rebel against his authority. So the king talked with them, and in all of the ones that he talked to, and we're never given a number for that, but none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, so they entered into the king's personal service. And then this kind of a two-verse wind-up of chapter 1. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. Now, the whole thing here is that Daniel is recording the evaluation that Nebuchadnezzar had of himself and his three friends, and the 10 times better, I don't know whether that's just a figure of speech that meant they were really superior or whether they were literally 10 times better. But the fact is, he wanted people in his ruling level of authority in his kingdom to be his advisors, to give him counsel and direction. And this comes out real big in chapter 2. Because in chapter 2, he's going to have a dream that bugs him. He can't sleep. Every time he closes his eyes, a dream comes back, and he is bugged. And he wants an answer, and he calls all his astrologers and magicians together, and they can't give him what he wants. And they say, well, tell us what you dreamed, and we'll tell you. Nah, I know what you're planning. You're going to come up with some cockamamie explanation. I want you to tell me what I dreamed, and then I'll know you can tell me what it meant. So that's what's going on in verse 20, is he's setting the stage again for chapter 2. And then in verse 21, he says, Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus. And that may mean that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah didn't. That they may have died before. I mean, they were there for 70 years, and I mean, there were Jews dying all the time. The promise wasn't if you were justified by faith, you'd live through the whole captivity. The promise was if you're justified by faith, the horror that Habakkuk saw of Babylon coming in and lopping people's heads off and cutting them all up and shooting their arrows, and he was promising them that the Babylonian warfare wouldn't result in their death. But he wouldn't promise them they'd live for the whole 70 years. It was just a promise that they wouldn't be subjected to the stuff that Habakkuk saw. And this whole thing about the first year of Cyrus, which in my notes here, it says approximately 538. So he's getting really close to the 70-year fulfillment thing. But in the record, Daniel has to first deal with the Medes, Darius the Mede, and then Cyrus the Persian. And that's the reason we call it the Medo-Persian Empire, because the Medes and the Persians had come together to go against Babylon. And the Median king apparently was dominant immediately, and then the Persian king took the ascendancy and became authoritative. So that's what's going on in chapter 1, and it's written in Hebrew as the prelude to the book. In chapter 2, the first three verses are written in Hebrew. And in verse 4, when it says, the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, from there on, all the way through chapter 7, it's in Aramaic. So we're really not quite through with the Hebrew part, but it's obvious that there's a big change in chapter 2, verse 1, because he talks about the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, and off we go.